Hi everybody, welcome to the Poetry Blog. Today we'll have Tyrone Williams with us. Tyrone, what did we talk about today?
On Spec, my second book of poetry from 2008, I'll be reading a poem from that book, entitled by H. Self, and I'll be talking a little bit about the title of that poem, as well as some of the other issues that poem raises, issues like African-American bodies, commodification, both during slavery and after slavery, and even after the Civil Rights Movement, which will lead us into discussions about social media, about political tendencies within social media, talk a little bit about academia, and a little bit about the worlds of poetry and academia and how those two worlds deal with it. You know, are contested within themselves, but also are very contentious across the perceived borders between poetry and academia.
Right. And meanwhile, the rest of the world's like, aren't poets and academics the same?
Right, exactly.
That resonance will come out a little bit
right.
too, I think.
Right.
This is a special episode because we ended up talking for 40 minutes. Never fear, students who are watching. The podcast edition will have our full conversation.
Right.
And the YouTube edition here will be about 20 minutes of that conversation. So if you're like, I kind of want to hear everything else you talked about, head over to the podcast. It's literally just the Poetry Blog on any podcast distributor. And if you want the 20-minute beautified version, hang in for this episode. Subscribe, like, follow us on social media, Google Tyrone's books, and enjoy this episode.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi everybody, welcome to the Poetry Blog. Today we have Tyrone Williams with us. Tyrone, will you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Tyrone Williams. I teach at Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm a poet and I've published 6 books of poetry and a few chapbooks.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. And where can people find you online?
Oh yeah, I think if you type in
Tyrone Williams,
that'll work.
Yeah.
My website, I think if you type in heretofore, that'll take you to my website.
Perfect.
Too. Okay.
And then folks that are watching will have all of this in the description below, and we'll also have it coming up on screen.
Okay.
If you're listening to the podcast edition, we'll have links to everything in the description of the podcast episode.
Okay, great.
So including the poem you're about to read.
Right.
Want to take it away and
read that? Sure. This is the first poem from my 2008 book On Spec, published by Omni Dom. And it's called Written by H. Self. The signature public, the only avant-garde behind invention. Wheelchairs in the street. Type A bleeds through the page or screen. It becomes a pool, as it were, one drop rolls. Individual talent divides tradition into ties, temps, and nationalized tribes. Catch as catch can, market share erosion. Staggered leads piggyback the gap. John Henry busted by Keaton. Gentlemen, he thinks, as the bespoken, it was the other kind of happy feet I wanted. Guess these shoes will have to have.
Thank you.
Sure.
Why did you choose that poem for us today?
Well, it's a poem that, as I said, it's the first poem in my book On Spec. And it's a poem that tries to announce that the rest of the poems deal not only with the issue of race, because in some ways that's the most explicit topic in the book, but also the topic of gender. And that's why it's obviously based upon the slave narrative mode, which were usually subtitled written by herself or written by himself. But in this case, the second and third letters are missing, so it's just H self. And so the poem sort of tries to announce that is dealing with these questions of gender in the very beginning. So that's one reason why I wanted to start with that.
Something I noticed was the flipping between like history and contemporary mm-hmm. ways for narrating these stories. Like most obviously the page or screen mm-hmm. becomes.
Right.
Right. And then the other thing I noticed was the use of pausing actually.
Right.
And like how much was cut out of it.
Right. Right.
Would you be willing to talk a little bit about those choices? Because I think right now the lyrical mode is really popular.
Right.
And in some ways this borrows from that. But this is also kind of resisting, I think, the lyrical mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of the pauses and certainly the issue between history and the contemporary, so the poem does try to talk about the ways in which African Americans in particular have how far we've come and perhaps how far we've not come in relationship to first the civil rights movement of the early 60s all the way back into the beginnings of the 20th century, and then of course, you know, from the from slavery to the present. And so, one of the things I'm trying to, the other thing I'm trying to get in, across, and particularly in the second line, the only avant-garde behind invention, that's alluding in a so distant way to a point I've tried to make elsewhere that the African American body is itself a kind of a ready-made. In terms of art, that is, the African-American body is something that has been taken from the quote-unquote functional world and turned into a kind of art object in many respects. So I'm trying to allude to a number of different ways in which African-Americans have been perceived by the dominant culture since at least, you know, the 19th century.
So kind of like the transition from commodity in terms of known racial slavery methods
right.
to commodity in terms of cultural commodity,
cultural commodities,
cultural arts, like and the like. There's I'm gonna blank now. The book I'm thinking of Against Race, Paul Gilroy.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Exactly. Paul Gilroy is.
Where he talks about how it becomes this kind of like you still don't get to be
right.
human, so
exactly.
to speak, or like have lived experiences. It's commodifying it
right.
in terms of its repackageability in a cultural circuit.
Right, and so that's you know that refers to I mean that's a good way of putting it because it does refer to the fact that African Americans continue to be commodified in different ways. I've often said that in some respects. The Civil War is still being fought today on different fronts, in different forms, and so that we haven't gotten beyond that in many ways.
This is something I agree with you on, obviously.
Okay.
But can you mind explaining a little more what you mean by the Civil War is being fought still on different fronts?
Okay, so that instead, it's not necessarily just the South. It's not obviously it's not the South and the North. Anymore.
Kind of.
Not entirely, right. There's still that, but not entirely. But rather, there are different ways in which African Americans, because when I refer to the Civil War, I'm thinking primarily about the question of rights, states' rights. You know, that's often said as one of the signature motives for the South rebelling against the Union. But and that issue of rights, federal rights versus states' rights versus you know civic rights, civil rights, and so forth. And so the question becomes, to what extent the issue of rights is still a big issue in relationship to African Americans. And one of the ways I think this comes about, and that was very influential for me, was reading the work of Harold Cruz. All his mistakes and errors and ad hominem attacks and others aside, I think his work was valuable for me because one of the things he argues is that until African Americans, you know, to a certain degree have possessions over the means of production, we will continue to be commodified in many different ways, economically, politically, culturally, and so forth. Now, that doesn't mean that even if we own the means of production, that wouldn't still happen. Obviously, it could still happen because we see that with black-owned companies, even today. But that at least was an important step that we had to take from his point of view. So some of these thoughts are in the poem, you know, and really throughout the book that I'm thinking about in terms of the way in which African Americans, it becomes very difficult to become, to be human, that we somehow that baggage that we carry with us is still being, you know, that still prevents us from being completely human.
Yeah, and then the category of the human is still presumed to be, right? Like the kind of voting, rights-bearing, property-owning, reproductive citizen.
Exactly,
right?
So that's a civil rights.
Racially, like, coded.
Exactly, right. that's very much a civil rights kind of version of what it means to be human, as opposed to, shall we say, other forms and even perhaps even more radical forms of what it might mean to be human.
Yeah.
Right.
And being allowed, like, fallibility.
Right.
Like having multiple dimensions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, people, you know, you hear this in many different versions today that, you know, African Americans can't afford to make, when African Americans make mistakes, it's not just an individual mistake, you know, it's a collective mistake on some level. Whereas when people from other races make mistakes, it's not necessarily, you know, I mean, that's still, today we could say that, for example, in terms of someone of Muslim faith, right, or someone from an Arab or Persian background, that those individuals also suffer the same kinds of grouping that African Americans suffer. That is, it's never just an individual act or a small number of acts. It becomes a collective act. You become, whether you want to or not, representative of the entire group.
Yeah. People assume representation is the end goal.
Right.
When oftentimes it's actually a hyper-representation that ends up enabling this idea that the person is a superhuman or is totally degenerate.
Right.
And isn't just like a person.
Right.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? And like multiple valences that require like a reading and seeing that both accounts for like race, sure,
right,
but also sees them as someone who's doing what they can where they are.
Right.
You
know
what I mean? And there's like really violent, like quite violent repercussions for African American folks and for non-white folks in general.
Right.
Whereas like, for instance, if I were to be like, well, I have to be a perfect white person.
Right, exactly.
A perfect white person who's
right.
low at home.
Right, exactly.
Not going to be like cuffed in the street.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean? So I think it's interesting that they're framing it in terms of civil rights and human too, because it's like a way of kind of pushing back against this idea that you're either like enslaved or superhuman.
Exactly.
And that there's like a different kind of refusal that's happening even in the portrayal of superhuman or...
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, and I've been doing a lot of work writing wise, both in poetry and elsewhere, on the whole question of representation as and its connection to the notion of authenticity. Now, a lot of people have taken this critique, are doing this kind of work too. It's not just me, obviously, but that's very important work from my point of view, is to undercut the notion of representation as much as possible, among other things, because it's been so damaging for African Americans. But you know, the nuance here comes that you, on the one hand, you want to critique this notion of the assumed connection between authenticity and representation, but without going to the other extreme, which is a kind of neoliberal individualism, you know, which is to say that, you know, I have no connections with anyone else, that every act or everything I do is this unique, thing that cannot be repeated or something like that, the other extreme version of that.
This is a maybe unfair, tough question.
Okay.
Can you think of examples of work you see as managing that kind of nuanced approach? You know, because I feel like oftentimes when we're in academia, criticism is necessary. It's always the first step before. Why would you build a new world if you don't have a criticism world?
Exactly.
But thinking about folks watching and listening, they're like, well, what type of work should I be examining that does this nuanced approach?
Right.
Obviously, yours is part of why I invited you here.
Okay.
So, obviously, I recommend reading Tyrone's poems. They're awesome. But is there any other, like, it can be multimedia. It doesn't have to be poetry, but, you know.
Well, one of the things I noticed is because I was in Portland earlier this week at Portland Northwest College of the Arts, talking with some MFA students in there. And it was interesting to me that there were two or three African-American women whose writing was in part on fantasy, science fiction work and so forth, and had very little connection to what we might think of as traditional notions of race or representation.
Yeah.
And what it suggests to me is the way in which, I mean, it was a perfect example of what I'm talking about, that not all African-American people or cultures or writers or artists of any sort are necessarily wedded to these traditional topics and themes.
Black people don't have to write about being black?
Exactly, right, exactly. I know it's shocking, yes, we don't have to write about that particular, that particular issue. So that's, so the, and that, that suggests to me also that there's a kind of regionalism to this too, that the experiences of people in the South are not the same as those in the Southeast, you know, versus those in the Northeast, you know, the Midwest, and so forth. In terms of other people who I know, are, I mean, so I think about this mostly in terms of literature, because that's what I, you know, I do, and I think about this in terms of the work of, so, you know, this is a novel from the, I think, the 70s, a novel, Oreo by Fran Ross, a novel that's very little known outside of academia, maybe even within academic circles. But it's a novel about a half-black, half-Jewish young girl, and it's sort of framed within the epic, you know, this epic journey that she goes on to find her father. So it's a rewriting of the traditional, you know, Greek epic. It's a very interesting novel because, you know, as the title suggests, Oreo. And that also tells you it's from the 70s because that was a term of an epithet that was used against African-Americans who were perceived to be, quote-unquote, too white. So that's a work that I think is in that regard. But I also think the work of people like Dario Harris and Don Lundy Martin, you know, in terms of poetry, and I was doing that kind of work too. And I'm sure there are many others whose names are not coming to mind immediately, but yeah, I think people like that are doing that kind of necessary work.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk a little bit from your craft perspective and looking at like the genealogy of your own work, if you've noticed a sort of, if you've noticed things that you increasingly read as somewhat regional, if that makes sense, or see as like, this is like how in the Midwest and then more specifically Detroit versus Cincinnati, right? Like these topics are approached versus when you travel to like Portland, for instance. And truly blindsided.
Right.
So you can be like, no, I'd rather not.
That's fine. I mean, there is in, so I, you know, I've talked about, you know, often talked about the differences between Cincinnati and Detroit, for me at least, when I, because I came to Cincinnati in 1983 after living, you know, the first 29 years of my life in Detroit. And Detroit at that time, you know, was, at least from my point of view, this kind of hotbed of culture and radical politics. Now, when I talk about Detroit, I'm talking about specifically the Wayne State, Cass Corner area that I grew up in, I mean, went to school in, and was very influential about my own ideas of poetry and so forth. But of course, my ideas of poetry started before that, before I went to college. You know, I grew up in the middle class, Detroit, black neighborhood. So it's been this strange, for me, Detroit was this strange combination of, on the one hand, I was getting, you know, exposed to all these radical new ideas around the Cass Corridor area and Wayne State area. But at the same time, as I said, I grew up with these fairly middle-class values too. So it was an interesting kind of, maybe not sinking, maybe just kind of dissonance between those two things. And then when I moved to Cincinnati, I definitely felt like alienated, you know, because it seemed completely unlike any other experience I had ever had. And so, but then I realized sort of belatedly that this, well, Cincinnati is a southern city, and I, you know, I had never lived in a southern city, even though this is just across on the north side of Ohio, is still very much a southern city. So I would also say that, you know, beyond that, my reading, you know, because I was always reading beyond my, you know, my geographical area, and I was, as I said, drawn to experimental, you know, radical works of art, both not just writing but music and literature. I mean, artwork, music, and artwork, and so forth. So I realize I'm repeating things over and over again, but I would say all of those things have influenced me. And as I said earlier, I realized also that a place like Portland, for example, that to be African-American in Portland is not the same as being African-American in Seattle, and certainly not the same as being African-American in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And so I think those are all, I mean, there's connections, no doubt, due to history, but, you know, I think the experiences, particularly in terms of individual experiences, remain fairly unique.
Yeah. And I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here.
Sure.
but I'm thinking now about how often, and one reason I asked it is both poetry world, so to speak, mm-hmm. and students watching this, you're about to get a dip a little bit into that.
Right.
And academia world, mm-hmm. they go to these conferences, for instance,
like
MLK's this weekend,
exactly. Right.
And these issues are talked about in terms of being like a nationally or internationally featured development, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know if a lot of the conversations in both worlds talk much about the very specific differences of race, gender, and sexuality in different regional areas at great length. I mean, they'll do it
mm-hmm.
in terms of this is Midwest, but not necessarily Cincinnati versus Detroit.
Right.
They'll be like, this is the Northwest, but not like Yakima versus Seattle.
Right.
And I sometimes wonder, and this sounds very scary from the Sex and the City, but lately I've been thinking about if maybe some of the friction that people feel with poetry and academia is that it tends to take these hyper local and nuanced specific examples of what that identity means in that space
mm-hmm.
and try to expand it into something that's retweetable, re-Instagrammable, or could be presented in a national or international conference and carry like nuance in a way that reads to other regions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think prior to social media, I think there was still the sense, so first of all, I think the divide between, shall we say, the world of poetry and the world of academia was always there.
Yeah.
From we've been talking about
yeah.
that, you know, before this, that was always a divide and a very contentious divide, too. And then with the emergence of social media, and because of the changes in academia, particularly the ways in which universities are now feeling financially stressed, and with the sort of, if you will, sort of leveling of the hierarchies, some of the hierarchies, I should say, within the poetry world, and so that everything becomes much more atomized now, both within the poetry and between the poetry world and academia. And so it becomes, so when people, but because of social media, people want to, on one hand, articulate their very specific individual experiences in both poetry and academia, but at the same time, they often want to make these larger claims about academia and about poetry. And so it becomes very difficult then to sort of track, and or even to make sort of general statements about what's happening between these two communities, because, in part, the economic relationships between them are changing. When I was in college, you know, poets got hired all the time based simply on their publications,
yeah.
you know, without degrees. That's no longer the case. You need a degree in order to get hired. And not just MA or MFA, but rather, you know, a so-called terminal degree
mm-hmm.
in literature or in another field connected to literature. So that has made, obviously, people in the poetry world feel much more intense the sort of divide between academia and poetry than previous generations. And so, from my point of view, it's difficult to recommend people who. But to recommend people who are poetry to necessarily pursue the the academic thing, among other things, because the jobs in academia are changing too as we move away from tenure. And move toward more adjuncts or temporary full-time jobs without tenure, which is what administrations tend to prefer. So that, you know, as it were, the legs are being cut out from under both professions in that respect. And so it's, you know, the future doesn't look bright in that way, you know, which is not to say that you shouldn't pursue, but it's, I mean, that's just the reality, is that the dynamics are changing fairly rapidly in terms of what's going on. So I you know, we were talking earlier about the connection between Josie, fascism, and social media.
Yeah, I'd love to go there.
Right, exactly.
Like the secret lecture I always want to
right,
hear.
Exactly. And I definitely think there are tendencies that simply structurally speaking, and that make social media in general, just a, you know, in the most general sense, very amenable to fascist tendencies. Even on the level that we were talking about earlier, in terms of it's difficult for people to process information as simply, you know, people access information, but they don't necessarily process it. And so people react immediately to things, and even misread and misinterpret things because of social media. And in large respect, the so-called cancel culture, you know, so forth, is related to that. Even as social media has allowed for greater, you know, different forms of solidarity among individuals who are separated by geographical or social cultural barriers.
Would you be, this will go over our time a little bit, and we can either keep it or cut it if you want later.
Oh, okay.
But would you be willing to talk a little bit about what we were talking about earlier with, like, not necessarily exact what happened with Twitter, but thinking more in terms of, like, the oversimplifying and taking out nuance to jump to more black and white moralisms and reckoning that with, like, poet readership has doubled, right? Like, how do you put the two?
So just to address the first question, the second question first, I mean, I think the readership, I mean, this is one of the positive developments, I think, in some respects, is that the readership of poetry and other art forms, you know, has certainly increased because it's more accessible, particularly as things like libraries, you know, continue to get defunded or underfunded. Mm-hmm. You know, places where people used to go, public places where people used to be able to go to access information. So that, in that sense, you know, it's a good thing that social media has allowed people to have access to art forms, you know, in the way they are structured and institutionalized that they weren't able to before. So that's, I think that's a positive thing. But unfortunately, as I said earlier, one of the other aspect of this is that, and again, this is the very nature of the internet and social media, is that it's difficult to concentrate, and to read, to dive deeply, if you will, into text, especially when there's such a proliferation of other information, maybe just as interesting, maybe even more interesting information out there. And so it's difficult to concentrate in the most literal sense of that term on particular texts and to dive deeper. The other thing, of course, is the crowd factor, you know, that it's very judgment on artworks tend to be very facile, very quick, and so forth.
And like crowd-based.
And crowd-based.
So it's like numbers of support equals validity.
Exactly.
Right? And disagreement with the majority equals cancellation.
Exactly, right, exactly. And of course, I mean, we had those sort of things in the analog world too, obviously, you know, that's why we had, you know, canons, as it were, say within the literature, which were in some ways the opposite of the digital world, because the notion of the canon, for example, was not based upon the number of people who support, but rather on a small group of people who were presumed to be experts about what was the best.
Obviously,
mostly
white
right, exactly.
Who are not yet dead.
Right, exactly, not yet. Yeah. So, but yeah, there's still the same dynamic obtains in both cases. But I think, it's very easy to make snap judgments on texts, even texts that appear in print on in digital formats, as opposed to nuance. And then the crowd factor, you know, that people begin to pop the piling on and so forth.
And what's rewarded materially too, because if crowd support equals the odds of you getting a book deal, there's an implicit ideal of like something that's simplified down to like a certain character limit, and there's an immediate black and white moral judgment. that creates a crowd of backer support. And these are good things too, not to be like slamming. I mean, it's good that in many ways poetry publication practices have become more democratized, and it's necessary that a lot of these changes have been made.
Right.
But when you're like also a scholar, for instance, and a historian, what gets scary about it sometimes is if the change doesn't reflect a critical awareness of what it's keeping of the old guard.
Right, right, exactly.
Just because it's on Twitter doesn't mean that it's radical.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because these are formats that are, you know, apolitical in and of themselves, you know. Although, as I said earlier, they do facilitate certain dangerous forms of superficial, and as we say, even fascist rationalizations, where it becomes important to simply follow the crowd as opposed to, you know, to step back and think critically about what's being, and what's being said or tweeted or posted, as the case may be. So, yeah, this is obviously not a diminished, because first of all, it wouldn't make a difference if it was, if it were being diminished or not, because it's here, and there's no going back.
When you're a critic, when you criticize something, it doesn't just disappear.
Go away. Right, and that was hard.
You have to think of other possibilities.
Yeah, think about it continually. So, as we were saying about teaching, you know, we can do all the hemming and hawing, crying over the demise of the book all we want. But the fact is, our students do not relate to the books in the way in which previous generations did. And so you have to, I think if you want to be a teacher today, you have to be relevant. You have to get on board with doing much more, as you said, multimodal kind of things to keep your students engaged. That doesn't mean abandoning, you know, prior formats, but it does mean, you know, using other different things to keep students' attention. And not only that, but to recognize that this is the way the students will be engaging in the world when they leave the university.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to embrace those changes. You know, and if you want to hem and haw, that's fine. You know, I do a little bit of that too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think it is important to embrace these changes. And again, that would include social media.
Yeah. Learning how they work.
Learning how they work.
What you need to do within it. Or like to even go back to the beginning of the conversation, we're talking about the commodification of African American bodies. Social media has been one of the biggest mobilizers of that.
Exactly.
And oftentimes in the guise of like radical political maneuvering. So it's like, how do we as like contemporary, like scholars and artists, learn how the tools of social media function in order to kind of create the types of change we would wish to see in the world, while also being really aware of how it can just as easily be refashioned to perform the same type of like marketing of identity, basically, in order to kind of soothe typically white egos of audiences.
Exactly, because you know, I mean, this goes back, and just to show you, this isn't new. It's it goes back to the whole phenomenon of the so-called the New York intelligentsia and the Black Panthers, how they fawned over the Black Panthers. They loved the parties that were thrown for the Black Panthers in, elite New York society circles.
Yeah.
And the Black Panthers were, saw themselves as dedicated to the destruction of capitalism. But that's another example of the way in which, as you said, the most radical articulations can still be, repurposed and recommodified for public consumption.
Yeah.
And we have a long history of that in this country.
This is something I've noticed with Black Panther in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, there's Black Panther, the Disney version.
Right.
That's just a given for another episode.
Right.
But I've noticed that it's almost like a lot of resistance movements are now being commodified that have passed or are more like residual, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're being retooled as today's resistance, but only insofar as it circulates in a performance space.
Right.
How do you both celebrate, encourage, and mobilize ongoing resistance while also facing the inevitable marketing of it?
Right.
And there's no answer per se, but like I think it's the question when we're, because you also teach multimedia text.
Right.
It's like that's the question you keep having to hit up against.
Exactly. Right. And you have to, because now those things become brand names, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I think the Spike Lee movie where at the end the kids, I think it might be Malcolm X, but they're all wearing caps and And so, and even though that's meant to be a kind of suggesting within the context of the movie that, you know, the legacy of Malcolm X is spreading widespread, it's international, you know, beyond his death and so forth. But the fact that the emblem that's used is a cap, you know, that you can purchase, suggests that the commodification of someone like Malcolm X, like the commodification of the Black Panthers, is something that cannot be avoided within the context of American, you know, our economic system under capitalism. Now, that's just something that's going to happen.
Yeah.
What that means then is that, from a critical point of view, it's important to continue to push against that, you know, that kind of commodification. Or to another way of thinking, that maybe this is what you were getting at, to use commodification, the tools of commodification to try to undermine commodification.
It's a little bit.
As much as possible.
I hear like Audre Lorde in the back of my brain.
Right, right, like, exactly. I hear
tools.
Cannot be used by. I hear.
Yeah, exactly. So I know we're ending on a kind of ambivalent note.
Oh, okay.
which is kind of our traffic. Which maybe suits it. But is there anything we didn't cover today that you're like, well, I kind of want to talk this other thing, and then you threw me into talking about Twitter?
No. That's fine. I can't think of anything that we
yeah.
Is there anything that you wanted to talk about or ask that?
Oh gosh, I mean, canning a conversation to 20 minutes
know,
for me
right,
as you witnessed after
right.
coming over today is like the impossible. So
right, right.
I feel really grateful that you participated this long and were
well,
willing
I,
to
I'm,
take all these blindsiding.
That's okay.
You all don't know this, but this was today's interview. So you and Cameron are the least amount of preparation I've ever given someone. So like we were gonna read something.
Yeah,
like,
just talk about something. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm grateful.
Well, I'm grateful that you asked.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for making the time.
Sure.
I'm going to shamelessly plug another episode real
Absolutely.
Quick. There's an episode with Sarah Dowling on neoliberal multiculturalism that talks about this exact topic, but in the framework of like global multilingualism. She like close reads a Coca-Cola ad.
Right.
Of like multiple languages singing the national anthem as emblematic of a kind of similar problem of
right.
representation. Do you know what Sarah Dowling?
Oh, I know. Sarah's great.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
She's one of my mentors.
Oh, she is? Okay.
She's just wonderful. Sorry.
Sorry.
I might have a student get that out or not because she deserves to get the credit she deserves.
She's wonderful.
She's wonderful. She was the first scholar that agreed to do the project, actually.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Maybe because I was like, she's also a friend. But
yeah.
I think the episode will pair well with this. I might even put them together.
Okay.
So if you're a teacher watching this, I think these two would actually function quite well together.
Okay.
Because they're talking about similar issues. And then I can't recommend enough to go buy Tyrone's books. And you're one of the more Googleable people you've got out of the project. So if you're
Speaking
like.
Of commodification.
Yeah, exactly. Back to the brand.
Right, exactly.
All of the links are in the description. But if you're like me and you're kind of like loath to go to links and descriptions, know you can find most of the things on Google. If you're listening to the podcast version, we'll have had the actual words that we referenced. So different names you brought up, different movements and images pop up on the screen. And vice versa, if you're watching the video and you're like, I could have just listened to this, there's a podcast edition of this.
Okay.
It's available on any podcast distributor through anchor.fm.
Okay. Great.
I'm going to shamelessly plug some vlog items and then we'll sign off.
Okay.
ThePoetryVlog.com now has the home base for Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, the podcast, but it's also now developed with a bunch of students who've done incredible work to co-produce, co-edit, and co-design it. So by the time this episode's gone live, you'll get the credits at the end of the video, but you'll see ways that they've made sure this will be a more accessible project. And one of those is we created an archive of playlists based on topic. So if you're kind of curious about videos for teaching or learning based on topic, you can go to thepoetryvlog.com and go to the Poetry Vlog drop-down menu, and that's one of the options.
Okay.
It's something I'm really excited about, so I'm pushing it more with a certain amount of shame. I'm not gonna say shame. There's just this small amount of shame that comes with that, but whatever. All right. Like, subscribe, etc. Thank you, Tyrone. I really appreciate your time
today.
Thank
you, Chelsea. I appreciate it.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for taking all my breaks.